Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Adam Johnson, a New York-based journalist, who explains why he believes U.S. corporate media is failing to provide critical reporting on U.S. foreign military operations and indications that America is deepening its intervention in Syria's bloody civil war. Rebecca Craven, program director with the Pipeline Safety Trust, who talks about a Wisconsin zoning board's demand that a proposed tar sands pipeline pay for spill insurance. And Peter Jenkins, an attorney with the Center for Food Safety, who takes a critical look at the Obama administration's plan to protect honeybees and other endangered pollinators. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
For years, freight trains carried desperately poor migrants from Central America through Mexico towards the border with the United States. It was a dangerous journey as hundreds of migrants piled on the top of rail cars. Now, a crackdown by the Mexican police has forced many Central American migrants to find even more dangerous routes to the U.S. border. According to critics, Mexico's border operation called Programa Frontera Sur has a brutal record where migrants are routinely subjected to rape, assault, extortion, and murder. Mexico's aggressive border enforcement came in reaction to last spring's flood of 50,000 Central American children who crossed Mexico into the U.S., motivated by fear of high levels of violence at home. Officially, Mexico's South Border Program's goal is to protect migrants and combat criminal gangs and traffickers. But in reality, the security initiative has made it nearly impossible for migrants to travel safely in Mexico. The inequities and extreme violence that are driving people out of Central America continue unabated. Advocates believe the same number of migrants will still enter Mexico, trying to make it to the United States. At the peak of the civil rights movement in the late 1950s and 1960s, American labor unions were a critical ally for the movement in raising funds and helping mobilize for the 1964 March on Washington. Despite their steady decline in membership, the African American community still has a high regard for unions, with a historic connection that could spark a revival in labor's ranks amid the emerging Black Lives Matter movement. According to the news magazine In These Times, Black unemployment nationwide is twice as high as white joblessness. The racial wealth gap is rising, with $142,000 in average net worth for white households versus $11,000 in wealth for the average Black family. In the swing state of Ohio, African Americans hold 20% of all public sector jobs, where collective bargaining rights have come under severe attack by Republican politicians. Mark Meinster, director of Warehouse Workers for Justice, noted, "Working in a warehouse was once a high-wage union job, but in the past two decades, there has been a massive explosion of non-union temp employment with around 80,000 temp workers in the local industry. The remaining direct hires are often subjected to structural discrimination, including the misuse of criminal background checks, forcing much of the Black workforce into the temp agencies that pay as much as $6 an hour less in wages. Key economic sectors such as warehousing and transportation would be positively impacted with a concerted union campaign to organize Black workers." Softball coach Jonathan Smith was surprised a few years back when his 12-year-old son said he felt like a girl. Now, 3 years later, his youngest child goes by the name Heather, a member of the growing number of transgender teens. Transgender is suddenly hot in the media culture, with shows like Orange is the New Black and Amazon's Transparent. Just as 1998's groundbreaking TV show Will and Grace changed America's attitudes toward the gay community, this is a powerful moment for the transgender movement. According to the Christian Science Monitor, governments, school districts, and big corporations are responding to the new transgender visibility by adopting inclusive policies on gender. In 2014, the Obama administration ended a 33-year ban on Medicare coverage for transition-related care and sex reassignment surgery. Now, 9 state insurance commissions have instructed insurers to cover transition care as medically necessary. Like gay and lesbian youth 20 years ago, transgender youth are often rejected by their families, endure high rates of homelessness, and experience public discrimination in the workplace. Increasingly, hospitals and research institutions, from Seattle to Boston, have begun to focus more attention on causes and treatments for what is clinically known as gender dysphoria or gender identity disorder. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
A White House briefing on May 16th announced that 24 American Delta Force commandos had earlier that day launched a raid into eastern Syria, killing a leader of ISIS and an estimated 12 other militant fighters. The raid, which killed the man identified as Abu Sayyaf, purportedly an ISIS military planner and director of the group's illicit oil, gas, and financial operations, also captured his wife and an 18-year-old female Yazidi slave. Corporate media reports on the raid that were sourced to the Pentagon stated that the operation succeeded without any U.S. or civilian casualties. Media outlets reporting the story explained that their information had come from Defense Department officials and could not be immediately verified through independent sources. Although the U.S. had mounted an unsuccessful hostage rescue operation inside Syria last summer, this raid was the first known American combat mission undertaken in sovereign Syrian territory. Your reporter spoke with Adam Johnson, a New York-based freelance journalist and contributing writer to Alternate and Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Here he discusses his recent article titled, White House Reveals Boots on the Ground in Syria, but Media Too Giddy Over Special Operations Porn to Notice, and his view that corporate media is failing to provide critical reporting on U.S. foreign military operations and indications that America is deepening its intervention in Syria's bloody civil war.
This entire war with ISIS has been marked by a very slippery slope. If you recall, on August 7th of 2014, we were going to engage in, quote, limited, unquote, humanitarian missile strikes. So now we're about 10 months in, and we now have troops in Syria. We have troops in Iraq. We are bombing two different countries. And the war keeps expanding in scope. You saw this also in Libya in 2011. It is marked by mission creep. And the problem is, you know, it's the old parable of the frog in the boiling water, right? If you throw a frog in boiling water, he'll jump out. If you put a frog in water and you turn up the heat, he will burn to death. And that's what you're seeing with this war. And it's something we saw with other wars. We saw it with Vietnam, obviously. And the problem is when these meaningful sort of leaps of scope happen, which I think sending troops to Syria is a big leap, they're so bogged down by the kind of special forces minutiae, which is all, of course, handed down by the prose writers at the Defense Department and the White House, we don't really stop to actually put it in context. And I think that the problem with this war is that we don't really do that very often. Every time there's an incremental or a meaningful leap in the scope, it's usually completely glossed over by the media, and before we know it, we're engaged in a much broader campaign than that was originally sold to us.
How could the major newspapers and electronic news media in this country have covered this story differently to really impart the critical nature of this new kind of intervention in Syria's civil war?
Well, there's a couple of things at work here. First off, there's the runaway arrogance that America can send what is effectively a death squad, we'll call it special forces, to any country at any time to kill people without any international sanction, to say nothing of congressional sanction, whenever they want. And that's the underlying ethos of the American media, that there is no sort of kind of even legal apparatus as to why they can do that. So that's kind of the first thing that I think we haven't really stopped to think about. And that's obviously been going on much before this. And the second thing is the degree to which, what do we mean when we say boots on the ground? And I use that term very deliberately, and it was a term used by other commentators, because we have boots on the ground in Syria. Now you could say, oh, it's not a standing army, it's not boots on the ground. Well, okay, then our problem isn't boots on the ground, it's boots on the ground for X amount of time, and we need to stop and figure out what that means. And the people of Syria or the Syrian government which we kind of refer to pejoratively as the Assad regime, doesn't really make much of a distinction in terms of that is their sovereign territory. We sent our military in there. And I think that we haven't really stopped to kind of put that in proper context.
You say that people can be on all sides of this issue about U.S. troops intervening in Syria's civil war. But your gripe and many other people's gripe is that the U.S. media really doesn't inform the American public about these critically important decisions made in Washington, mostly behind closed doors.
Yeah. And so when we have these leaps in scope, what you're given is what is effectively a DOD action movie prose. And what I compare it to is that when the bin Laden raid happened on May 1st of 2011, we were given a series of things that later turned out not to be true. We had a narrative about human shields. They were throwing women in front of themselves. There was a firefight. A lot of these things, even setting aside Seymour Hersh's revelations, even if one doesn't even believe that, a lot of material things later turned out to be false. And of course, the reason is that, as I.F. Stone says, all governments lie. And so we have another raid here, and there's this very sort of, very sort of sexy narrative about special forces going in there. There's a helicopter missile. There's a slave they rescue to give it a kind of, more kind of moral gravitas. They kill 40 people who are all using women and children as human shields. But don't worry, we didn't kill any women and children. They kill the bad guy, and of course he has a huge cache of information that will later help them catch other ISIS members. There is absolutely no doubt that some percent of that is complete BS. Again, historically, that we know these raids are overhyped. And the media kind of repeats it. Now, again, as I mentioned in my article, to the New York Times credit, they have what has to be the most passive-aggressive disclaimer in the history of journalism, where they say none of these things could be independently verified. And, of course, they can't. So there's a credibility issue with the Defense Department. And I think that, right, when you're reporting on these things that are in these far-off regions where there's no way of corroborating anything, is that the media has no choice but to repeat, literally just rewrite what the Pentagon tells them. And I don't think there was nearly enough skepticism with this last raid. And I do think they buried the lead in terms of there being troops in Syria and how that actually has a big leap in terms of what the scope of the war was.
That was Adam Johnson, a New York-based freelance journalist and contributing writer to Alternet and Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Find links to Johnson's recent articles and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Pipeline company Enbridge was responsible for the 2010 spill of diluted tar sands bitumen into Michigan's Kalamazoo River that has thus far cost more than $1 billion to clean up, although the job isn't yet finished. Now the company wants to double the amount of tar sands bitumen it sends through its existing pipeline number 61 across Wisconsin so that it would carry 1.2 million barrels of the highly polluting fossil fuel a day, more than the proposed capacity of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. But Wisconsin's Dane County Zoning and Land Regulation Committee are calling for the company to pay an additional $25 million in insurance before it can build a pump station to move the higher volume of tar sands. Enbridge is fighting that requirement, arguing that the county committee overstepped its bounds and crossed into the jurisdiction of federal pipeline regulators by trying to regulate safety operations. While the company also maintains the added insurance is unnecessary as Enbridge would be liable for any future cleanup, the debate has effectively delayed the plan to increase the pipeline's capacity. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Rebecca Craven, program director with a nonprofit pipeline safety trust based in Bellingham, Washington, a group founded after a 1999 gas pipeline explosion in that community that killed three people. Here she describes what options Dane County has regarding pipeline regulation in Wisconsin and how Enbridge is pushing back.
So Line 61 is currently in the ground. Its capacity is right now about 560,000 barrels a day. After the Phase 2 upgrade is complete, if it's complete, its capacity would increase to about 1.2 million barrels a day. It's a 42-inch line, so yes, it would exceed the proposed capacity of Keystone.
So Dane County is trying to require an increase in insurance that the company would have to pay in order for Enbridge to go through their jurisdiction. Is that right?
The upgrade to increase the capacity of Line 61 requires a number of additional pump stations across Wisconsin, and one of them is in Dane County. And so Enbridge applied for a conditional use permit under the Dane County Zoning Code, and as one of the conditions of approving that permit application, the commission is requiring both general liability insurance but also environmental liability insurance in the amount of $25 million, and that's, as I understand it, to protect the interests of the county should there be a spill or some other accident. It would provide coverage for the assets that belong to the county.
Rebecca Craven, it's sort of a dance that goes on because the county has said it's not trying to regulate the pipeline or even stop the expansion of the pipeline because that's not in their purview. Can you say more about how the federal, state, and county jurisdictions over different aspects of this might play out?
Sure. So there are limits to the county's jurisdiction. There are certain things that are preempted from state and local authority by the Federal Pipeline Safety Act. There are several federal cases, however, holding that the imposition of zoning requirements on pipeline-related facilities is not preempted, that they are not safety regulations. So things like imposing a setback or sound limitations or screening for aesthetic purposes. One county in Maryland, Prince George's County, denied a permit for the construction of a liquefied natural gas storage facility because the company was proposing to put it in an area that the county had designated in its comprehensive plan as designed for future transit-oriented residential and commercial development. And the federal court upheld the county's denial of the permit on that basis, in spite of the operator's claim that their denial was preempted. So there are things that counties can do under the exercise of their zoning authority, and Dane County is doing that. They're exercising their zoning authority and imposing conditions on the permit that they feel will best meet the county's needs.
And Enbridge is fighting it. Where does this get resolved?
As I understand it, Enbridge has appealed the conditions on the permit. I've not yet seen that appeal, so I don't know exactly what it says, but my understanding is that that appeal will go to the full county board for a hearing. And beyond that, I honestly don't know if one or the other parties was unsatisfied with the result there. I don't know where it goes on appeal. I assume under state law there's typically some court-level appeal for zoning issues that don't get resolved at the local level.
So it seems that the more local jurisdictions like counties, which are closer to whatever impacts these projects would have, are not powerless in the face of these deep-pocketed corporations or the Obama administration's all-of-the-above energy strategy.
No, there are some things they can do, and typically within their existing zoning jurisdiction, some counties across the country have adopted ordinances to specifically call out pipelines and their related above-ground facilities to make clear that they're subject to the local zoning code. And I should clarify here, there is one subset of pipelines and facilities that counties really don't have much jurisdiction over, and that is those that are subject to the jurisdiction of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and those are interstate natural gas transmission lines. So big transmission lines that cross state boundaries and the facilities that are necessary to move that gas, those are for the most part, outside the jurisdiction of local governments to do much about in terms of zoning.
That was Rebecca Craven, Program Director with the Pipeline Safety Trust based in Bellingham, Washington. Find more news and commentary on the issues of pipeline safety by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Years of scientific research has found that a widely used type of insecticide poses a threat on par with that of DDT, endangering the world's ecosystems. An analysis, based on 800 peer-reviewed reports released last year, titled The Worldwide Integrated Assessment of the Impact of Systemic Pesticides on Biodiversity and Ecosystems, focuses on the harmful effects of neonicotinoids to bees and other pollinators, as well as terrestrial invertebrates like earthworms. As a phenomenon known as colony collapse disorder focused attention on the alarming population decline of honeybees and other pollinators, the Obama administration established the White House Pollinator Health Task Force in June 2014. Now, 1 year later, the task force has released its strategy to address the threat to pollinators, including the threatened monarch butterfly. But many environmental groups have criticized the task force approach, stating that while the plan places needed attention on improving pollinator habitat, it ignores the immediate danger posed by neonicotinoid insecticides, which scientific research finds responsible for the dramatic population decline. Your reporter spoke with Peter Jenkins, an attorney with the Center for Food Safety, who explains why his group and its allies believe the Obama administration's plan to protect honeybees and other endangered pollinators is far too weak to accomplish its goals.
Real dramatic indication of the decline of honeybees is that our national honey crop is on a steady decline. We're now producing far less honey than we consume and 25% less than we were 10 years ago. Last year, we had the worst U.S. honey crop ever. A lot of the beekeepers we work with will just tell you that wherever they are in the country now, there are too many pesticides, too many insecticides, and not enough good habitat. So a lot of the blame for the decline has been focused on a brand of insecticides that farmers are using really broadly. There's hundreds of products. They're all over the country now called the neonicotinoids. They're offshoots of synthetic nicotine. And they were brought onto the market with the notion that they weren't as dangerous to people or to mammals, but it turns out that they're terribly toxic in the way that they're used to insects of all kinds, as you can imagine, being insecticides. But their reach and strength and power and persistence as insecticides is overwhelming our invertebrate communities. And of course, they do the job that the chemical companies want, and to some extent the farmers want, I guess, but not really. But, of killing off some of the pest insects. But the problem is that they're killing off vast numbers of other beneficial species, including honeybees, bumblebees, solitary bees, and poisoning the water systems, too. They get into the water. And so overall, there's a great concern that really we're looking at sort of severe ecological catastrophe associated with the persistent insecticides that are being used now. Monarchs are a different story. So we've been talking about insecticides. Monarchs, the problem is, again, it's sort of in some ways it's a similar story because it's that they're using herbicides that are too good. Just like with the neonicotinoids, the insecticides they're using are too good. They're wiping out too many things. Well, monarch decline is to some extent actually caused by insecticides, but it's more directly caused by herbicides. And why is that? Well, because farmers are using new kinds of Roundup-ready crops, whether it's corn or soybeans or cotton. And what those are is they're genetically modified crops produced mostly by Monsanto, originated mostly from Monsanto. And with those crops, the farmer can go through and spray and kill all the weeds, but it won't kill the crop. That's why they're called Roundup Ready. They're resistant to Roundup or glyphosate, which is the same thing. So what does that mean? It means that all the farms now that use these herbicides are killing off all the good habitat for monarchs, including milkweed. And monarchs are huge and beautiful and charismatic. Butterfly populations are dependent 100% on milkweed. In their larval stage, they have to feed on milkweed. Well, the farmers have killed off all the milkweed because of these new crops that have come onto the market. What does that mean for monarchs? It means that over the last 10 years, well, maybe I think it's a bit longer, but more than about 10 years, the monarchs have declined 90% in population. And we know sort of what the monarch population is. We have pretty good counts. And we know that they're on a steep decline, and that's one of the reasons that, well, the driving reason why the Center for Food Safety, along with Xerxes Society and a couple of other groups, have petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to list the monarch as an endangered species, because we need to pull it back from the brink before it goes over the edge.
As these pollinators decline,
maybe you can make real for us. What's the impact on agriculture in this country and around the world?
Well, that's a great question. Actually, it's shooting yourself in the foot, obviously, if you're the agricultural industry writ large, to do harm to pollinators, because so much of agriculture depends on pollinators. Many observers are saying that by killing off pollinators, we're really, and the broader sort of insect life out there, we're really destroying the foundation of agriculture and healthy soils.
What did the Obama administration's Pollinator Health Task Force recommend in terms of action to protect pollinators? And why has your group, the Center for Food Safety, believe it falls well short of what must be done now?
It was good that President Obama was listening to what was going on with pollinators and paying attention, and he ordered his agency heads to get together and create a new plan to protect pollinators. And there's some good things in the plan, don't get me wrong, as far as preserving habitat, creating new habitat. But as far as these insecticide and herbicide problems that I've just talked about, they just basically did almost nothing on that. They weren't willing to take on the big chemical companies. And the fact is that the EPA, which is in charge of regulating these insecticides and herbicides, is very tilted towards industry's point of view as far as keeping these things on the market. So while there's some good goals in the President's Pollinator Task Force report, how could it be stronger? Well, you know, we've pointed out over the last 3 years of the administration that you've got some very good models to follow. In Europe, they looked at the same set of facts and they banned the use of these insecticides for major crops, corn and soybeans and other bee-attracting crops in 2013. And it looks like it probably will continue in Europe. So there's something that, you know, we were urging the U.S. government to follow that model. Similarly, in Canada, we've got a very good model where the province of Ontario has taken it on. And Ontario is where a lot of these crops are grown. And there's also a lot of beekeepers in Ontario. Well, they have decided to cut back the use of the neonicotinoids by 80%. That's their goal. So there's good models out there. There's good steps they could have done. They were 2 weeks, so we're going to have to keep the pressure on.
That was Peter Jenkins, an attorney with the Center for Food Safety. Find links to studies, articles, and commentary on the link between insecticides and endangered pollinators by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.